good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, on Skype, Terrence Taylor. In the studio, Sam Schreiber, and either Rob Cameron or Cam Rose. Five guests.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I was not happy that I had to miss Doctor Strange when it debuted last year. I really wanted to see it. Trailers lie, or at least give you skewed expectations. But if the film lived up to all the trippy visuals of its promo, it was something that I did want to experience. And my regret for missing it only doubled when I started seeing the film described as a consumer-friendly version of Enter the Void, French filmmaker Gaspar Noé's psychedelic tale of a dying drug dealer having an out-of-body experience in an electrically intense Tokyo. So finally, Doctor Strange is available for an affordable price on demand. I got to see it, and bluntly, it is very trippy and a lot of fun. It is also pretty much a prime example that Disney now has one script for Marvel films, and they just mad libs in the character names and MacGuffins and throw it in a director's lap to give it whatever flavor it might have. In the case of director Scott Derrickson, who hasn't particularly distinguished himself with films such as The Exorcism of Emily Rose and the remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still, this appears to be the opportunity he was waiting for. He just runs with it, turning earthly cities into fractalic battlefields that fold in on themselves and whole universes into neon-lit, chaotic voids. He even manages to tweak the vanquishing of the film's ultimate villain so that humor outweighs the stock might makes right finale. Doctor Strange isn't in any way the mordantly surreal experience that Enter the Void was, and it doesn't feature a sex scene with a first-person view from inside the vagina either. But for a commercial leveraging of non-mainstream cinematic techniques, it takes the audience to places they typically don't get to in a visit to the cinema. Doctor Strange does toy with the concept of alternate universes, and while I was watching the new animated film my entire high school sinking into the sea, I performed my own little alt-universe exercise as well. I imagined a universe where my entire high school, the film, also existed, and everything was the same. The film told the tale of a high school perched on a cliff that, thanks to the presence of a fault line underneath and an ill-advised construction of a rooftop auditorium, tumbles into the sea. As in our world, the story is seen from the point of view of a self-involved school newspaper journalist, who also happens to have the name of the film's director, Dash Shaw, who also scripted and is a well-published author of graphic novels in his own right. He's actually voiced by Jason Schwartzman in the film. And the scenario becomes a cross between The Breakfast Club and The Poseidon Adventure, as Dash and his companions, including best friend Asif, voiced by Reggie Watts, newspaper editor Verdi, voiced by Maya Rudolph, popular girl Mary, voiced by Lena Dunham, and lunch lady Lorraine, who's voiced by Susan Sarandon, and whose apron conceals the heroic soul of a Vin Diesel, fight their way to survival through corridors and stairways turned into death traps, and high school cliques hastily transformed into hostile tribes. The only difference is that in this other universe, the film isn't animated in a ragged, multimedia mixing style based on Dash Shaw's own artwork, but in the style of a second-tier CG animated film, something like The Ant Bully or Romeo and Juliet, say. And having its distinctive look replaced with more conventional animation, the question is whether my entire high school sinking into the sea with its satirical setup and pop culture ambience would rise above what regularly gets siphoned into theaters by major studios these days. My guess is that, yes, it actually would. I love the look of the film. Shaw's Photoshop animation style is crude but creative. The technology and its limitations are palettes for him, not crutches. But Shaw echoes John Hughes in his empathy for the social structures of high school and the fears and vulnerabilities of teenagers. Hyperbolic as the characters are, they retain their humanity, and that allows the film to become more than just an off-the-rack genre send-up. My entire high school sinking into the sea has heart beyond its laughs, and that makes all the difference. Another film that displays empathy within its hyperbolic premise is the live-action British production Purrvenge, which debuted a few weeks ago on the Shudder Network. In this case, we're dealing with an expectant mother, played by the film's writer and director Alice Lowe, who believes that her fetus is urging her to go on a murder spree in revenge for the death of its father. Lowe was also co-author and star of the dark comedy Sightseers, in which a pair of tourists discover a handy way of permanently neutralizing people who unwittingly disrupt their vacation. And Purrvenge shares that film's wry nastiness. But going solo here, Lowe explores some interesting nuances to her character, her ambivalence toward life growing inside her, and the madness that takes the form of a malicious, childlike voice, which I'm presuming is also Lowe's, goading her forward. Purrvenge is dark stuff, but not without soul. It's a compelling twist on the mad killer genre. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Yes. Yes, Terrence, we could hear you. I thought that you remembered how this worked. Oh, no, he's calling me. Gee, Terrence, you've done this before. I thought you knew how it worked.
I did it some time ago, Jim. We've done it once, and that was, what, 6 months ago?
No, my mic isn't working again. There we are.
Okay, well, I just hung up the phone, so yeah. There we go.
Okay, yes. No, everything that goes on Skype, including the call and the hang-up and everything, goes on the air, which is why I waited until the end of Dan's review to call you.
Okay. I was just confused as to whether I needed to click the phone or the camera. I clicked the camera and heard nothing.
I noticed you're not in the hammock.
No. So, do you want picture? You could watch me while I talk to you.
I would not, unless we could share it with the entire listening audience. I would.
There
not
we go. You'll have the same experience of me as the audience does.
Why don't you introduce yourself?
Since we're on the air, it's myself, Terrence Taylor. I hear a little bit of a hiss in the background. I don't know if that's going to.
No. We like you.
Ah, ha, 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 ha. Ah, the wit flows. Author of Bite Marks, Blood Pressure, and the in-process Past Life, which I've been working on this evening.
Which collectively are the Vampire Testaments.
The Vampire Testaments, yes. Yes,
very
still
good.
Testifying. It's mounting up. It's getting quite fun, actually.
You're also a video producer.
I am, of many things. I actually spent the day editing a video with a friend, Danielle, who's been on the show last week, I think.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, but yes, we've been merrily editing away.
She and Havla and were
one of the stars of our
one of the stars of your current project.
Our little
we're video we're our studio audience with Noah Beit Aron on the air, doing worst fiction, bad prose. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to see who could read it the longest and not crack up. And it was actually a listener caller from Canada who basically won the contest. And as I announced on the air, in case of prize, duplicate ties would be rewarded. I got that from an old episode of a show nobody here has ever heard of called Techie Time. But if you're out there, an old BAI listener, you will remember slops and sounds from the cutting room floor of radio station WBAI. Yes, it's Techie Time, a Rap Zang stereo production. And that was one of the first things I listened to before I worked at WBAI. BAI, which makes it old. And for the record, by the way, I have to say this because this is my weekly plea for help, and the date is coming up. May 1st, May Day, is my 50th anniversary working here.
Good God.
Yeah, indeed.
Now, what is the 50th anniversary? 25th is silver.
Yeah, 75th is diamonds. What is the
fee? Gold? Is it gold?
Sounds like that would be a standard, yeah.
Let's see. I'm in front of the internet.
I hope everybody can hear Terrence.
Golden wedding. Yes, gold. Gold.
Gold. It's gold. Okay.
They should give you some gold or something.
Yeah, I'll probably get a piece of Hanukkah gilt as a result. We now, like 2 weeks ago, we have a studio audience who will be more than an audience. here.
This and image of them sitting in a little booth or something.
We have to wake one of them up.
Do you have car keys taped under their seats?
Yes, but I don't know whose car they belong to.
Hot wire.
Point the mic more towards you.
I can just get closer. How about this?
Point it more at you. These mics are exceedingly low. Let me also raise the headphone. Say that again, Cam.
Yeah.
Oh, much better.
You know, the headphones seem okay to me.
Your headphones are in a different pot than mine.
Must be.
Yeah, they are. They are. Here are, I believe, your headphones. Try it now.
Oh, that's very different.
Yes, isn't it, though? Yeah. Mm.
Yes, folks, you heard it here. Ouch. The headphones are on pot at WBAI.
Actually, they are not alone, but we just came from the Hollow Nickel. Cam, introduce yourself, please.
Hello, my name is Cameron Roberson. My pen name is Rob Cameron, and I am a writer and organizer for Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers. I produce the Kaleidocast along with Sam Schreiber, Marcy Allen, Bradley Robert Parks, Jessica Plumley, and Terry Clark. And my latest fiction has been found in Clockwork Phoenix 5, edited by Mike Allen.
Squeeze.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
No, I was just commenting.
Come on,
The name of the short story that Rob read on the show a while ago is Squeeze, and it is merely superb. And people can see it also, by the way, by going to livestream.com to the search on the word clockwork. Terrence, are you all right?
I'm readjusting myself in my seat to be more comfortable, but also is turning off the heater, which is amazingly not actually
okay. Okay, it was just a very interesting series of noises that were coming out of the Gowanus. So
those were the noises that, well, no, they were not coming out of my Gowanus. They were coming out of my chair.
A different canal than I.
Indeed.
Sam, say hello, Sam.
He may not want to admit he's there at this point. I don't know.
I wouldn't blame him one tiny bit.
Well, no one can prove I'm here, really.
That's because we're on delay.
My name is Sam Schreiber. Like Cam, I am one of the co-editors and hosts of the Kaleidocast. And you can
Found at
SoundCloud. Also iTunes.
Sound on, yeah, but how do people You don't just go to SoundCloud and search.
As for KaleidoCast?
There's a web page that's easier.
Right, KaleidoCast.nyc.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. KaleidoCast.nyc, mm-hmm. and that will be the gateway to all things KaleidoCastic. Mm-hmm. And the first season finished about late summer, I believe?
Last May.
Mid-spring. Mm-hmm. And the next season is beginning early fall, mm-hmm. unless right. I'm mistaken. So... a fine podcast in the tradition of original fiction, such as we do at Lightspeed and Nightmare, and as Neil Clark does on Clark's World with the fabulous Kate Baker. And
you're definitely very happy with our table of contents this year.
Last year
was great. This is going to be
it is superb. You'll unveil it. Not long before, but people just keep your eye. Go to KaleidoCast.nyc. You have a few months to catch up to re-listen, because we assume you've already listened to the last series of episodes. Mm-hmm. And
12 and all.
Yeah, and this year 14. Mm-hmm. So that's a baker's dozen plus one. Mm-hmm. And because
that's a greedy baker.
It's a very selfless baker.
He has a sous chef, I think. I was trying to deliberate last night. Now, I have a lot of episodes of things that have been recorded, interviews I have done that need to find time slots, but each one of which needs work before they can go on the air. I have a three-hour interview with Tom Doherty, a creator of Tor Books, and many other imprints through the years, and that needs editing down. I did the Guest of Honor interview at Heliosphere with David Gerald, and David, once I told him that we were in what's called Safe Harbor, decided that meant...
Ah!
Thank you, Terrence. Yes, exactly.
Does that mean he started cursing?
Oh, bleep yes. And it was salt and pepper. So it needs a little bit of despicing. And then Saturday, I did the Guest of Honor interview for Lunacon with Dr. Ben Bova, who was the first time in like 30 years I had seen Ben. He, of course, used to be semi-regular on the show when he was editing Analog Magazine and later Omni. And it was very funny. There was sort of a full circle of Omni people at Lunacon this year because one of our readers was the fabulous, wonderful, amazing Elisa Quitney. Now, Elisa Quitney, her full name is Elisa Quitney Sheckley. She's the daughter of Robert Sheckley, who was the fiction editor at Omni magazine. And she was but a young girl when I met her in the offices of Omni, running into the office of the assistant editor, Ellen Datlow. Had Ellen been present at Lunacon, which will be a cold day in hell, I fear, we would have had like a whole full circle of the original Omni magazine there, which would have been cool. And it would make a good panel, so I hope everybody from other cons take note of that, because that should happen. And Melissa Quitney is now editor of, Liminal Comics. She was editor of Vertigo Comics. She edited any number of issues and co-wrote a number of issues of Sandman with some guy named Neil Gaiman. She was the editor of Norse Mythology by some guy, Neil Gaiman. She's worked with Neil for many years. Mm-hmm. And she was very cool at Lunacon, and we recorded her reading, and she's going to be coming on the show relatively soon.
She a New Yorker?
I'm sorry?
Is she a New Yorker?
She is, yes, but not a New York Cityer. Hmm. She's a New York Northerner. Not that far north.
I do feel as though we need a word for non-New Yorker city.
Don't say upstate.
Upstaters.
You're the one saying it.
Outsiders?
Terrence nailed it, yeah.
That's everyone outside of New York, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Drives people from Western New York up the wall. say upstate.
Now that I've redeemed
myself.
There's
a wall in Western New York? Trump has gone that far?
Yes.
Oh, geez.
It stops the Canadians from coming in.
Yeah, well, to stop Trump from coming in, I would hope. But
The 80s, we used to refer to the Canadians as the invisible aliens because they were everywhere. There were Canadians, and you never knew. You'd be talking, and suddenly they'd say something Canadian, and you'd be like, oh, my God.
But usually you can tell by the beaver pelt they always wear, right?
Well, no, no.
That actually wasn't
you could tell with like, oh, my God, I'm feeling sick. I should go to the doctor for free.
Well, you know, they often did have a casual sort of relationship with medical care. They weren't used to America yet. They got sick willy-nilly thinking they could just find easy cures.
I hate to get pedantic on everybody, but Canadians are Americans. They're just not USA.
They're North Americans.
They're North Americans. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's... But they would tell them that. I don't think they want to be referred to.
Actually, some do. Some are, in fact, are vehement about it, saying, you know, you are exclusionary and elitist if you don't include these members of North America.
That's what everyone outside of New York says.
Well, yes. And
but only, they're right.
But you know what? They're wrong because it's all about Brooklyn.
Yes.
It really is now. Mm. I so rarely go into Manhattan. It's amazing. It's,
yeah.
And when I do, it irritates the hell out of me. So.
You have to go to. I was in Clinton Street Bakery today, on a date, and now I have to go back again tomorrow. It's delicious food, but I really rather they just took the restaurant and moved it down a block from my apartment.
Mm.
That'd be nice.
I mean, I'm waiting for Wo Hop to come to my part of Brooklyn.
I know.
Wait 20 years till you've got my waistline. You won't want that bakery so close, trust me.
Yes, and Terrence.
Your metabolism is going at some point. I was as skinny as you.
I hate to get...
But I am. You will be what you are. I once was.
Terrence, I control the vertical. I control the horizontal. Let me just say that...
He left now. I'm coming back in 20 years with a tape measure. Uh-huh. I will have my revenge.
I just wanted to say one thing. Watch your peas.
House of the donut.
Watch your peas. You're popping them.
Oh, am I? Okay, let me move a little bit further away from the mic.
Yeah, you have a desk mic? Or
well, I'm
looking
now, so it's... Did I...
That's the problem with our popping
the microphone.
Your mic. Okay, so the reason we are gathered here, the agenda for this morning's program, there are several reasons. They are legion.
So to speak.
This is why I'm here, because I would just have to be hitting you right now.
Yes, exactly. And that's why it's safer to have you on Skype, because frankly, the other thing is that we're just out of your class.
Technically, though, I could probably like use one of these little apps to send money to one of the guys there in the room with you, and they could hit you.
Venmo.
Terrence, Terrence, you're over-modulating. You're over-modulating.
How about this? I will... Actually,
it's a Skype problem, and I don't know how to adjust your volume.
I'm trying to find a place for the mic. I keep thinking I should be closer, but the blue mic is actually better than I think it is. Is this non-popping and of adequate volume?
Yeah, slightly off mic, I would say, but not bad.
Okay, I can...
Of course, the mics in the studio pretty much suck anyway, so what can I say? Okay, so there we are, in case nobody is... No, by the way, thank you... Dan, for that lovely and insightful review of The Master of the Mystic Arts. I just wanted to add, I first encountered Dr. Strange when it was a radio serial on WBAI in the late 60s, about the same time that Steve Ditko was still drawing the comic. I don't follow comics much. I did read Doctor Strange. I had to therefore read Nick Fury because Tales of S.H.I.E.L.D. were the back story issues in Strange Tales.
Now, which I discovered in the Marvel Unlimited app and thought was one of the most bizarre combinations. And even as you were describing that, I was thinking, now that's odd bedfellows. And then I suddenly had a mental image of the Broadway revival of The Odd Couple with Nick Fury and Doctor Strange as Peter.
Now, see, if that appeals to you, you have got to read Marvel 1602, where Sir Nicholas Fury and court physician Dr. Stephen Strange enter.
I have the Marvel Unlimited app. I have read virtually everything at this point. It's frightening. I have read the 1602. They actually, it was very interesting. Mm-hmm. The adaptation of everyone's abilities to that period and milieu.
Yeah.
It was a little like those strange like side trips that Dark Shadows or other series take where it's like, or I should say, oh my God, and I'm dreading it, the new upcoming season of S.H.I.E.L.D. where everyone's in virtual reality with another identity and we have to get them out.
It's not upcoming. Oh, they're almost finishing it now.
I mean, I think my...
Oh, that's right, because it was like coming up 3 weeks later. Yes. Well, I haven't been watching it. I'll have to like go on my
DVR.
So
it's for you. It's not a... It's not, I thought it was actually pretty good.
But
it was
a lot better than
Ghost Rider.
Oh, yeah, but I was going to say that I think the moment that gave it permission to do everything came towards the end, where Sir Nicholas Fury talks a amnesiac Steve Rogers down by saying, look, Steve, you know Nick Fury in your time, would he lie to you? And Steve Rogers finally comes down from the tree he's in or something, and Sir Nicholas Fury says, you know that Nick Fury you know from the future, I'm not him, and just bashes his head in with a rock.
There you go. Yeah. But at any rate, I was, as I was saying, that WBAI, and this is the point that was at hand, folks, before we totally end up with 2 hours gone and we don't get to talk about our subject, WBAI ran Doctor Strange for more than a year as a weekly radio serial with Baron Mordo and Dormammu and the whole thing.
Who was the voice of Doctor Strange?
I believe it was a gentleman it was a gentleman by the name of Charles Potter, who you have not heard of.
Okay. So this did not launch his career then, this adaptation?
Charles Potter is still doing very well, doing voice work and stuff like that. Another actor who was in the crew at that time, Timothy Jerome, is winner of more than one Tony Award for Best Actor. I saw him in Grand Hotel. And then there was this guy named John Lithgow, and I think he fell off the face of the earth.
Did he do Mordo? Because I was going to say, I would love to have heard it if he did Mordo. Both Mordo, Lizardo, it would have been the whole stream of Ardo villains.
Dormammu?
It would have been I think that Lithgow mostly just did some narration in that particular version.
At any rate, this does at least get us onto the topic of Marvel Comics, so at least we're getting closer to Legion.
Okay, so let us just briefly state, starting with me, and then going around the room, and then ending with Terrence, how familiar people are with Legion. To me, Legion was a TV series written and created and directed by Noah Hawley, who did, I knew him first from his bizarre, appropriately bizarre, TV adaptation of Fargo, series 1 and 2, where he gave Martin Freeman Dakotan accent, and which he actually handled fairly well. Yeah, it slipped. It slipped. Sam is going, I mean, he's no Francis McDormand, let's put it that way. But I loved the TV series Fargo. It was not the movie, thank God. And I loved the movie. I'm a big Coen Brothers fan.
Huh. You could watch the movie? Even with the wood chipper scene?
Yes.
I love the wood chipper scene.
Excuse me, there's no gore.
Even
in that
with
scene.
The wood chipper scene? That movie is nothing without the wood chipper scene.
I mean, the scene where the
Rob is challenging me because I said I don't like on screen gore. Excuse me, there is no on screen gore in the movie Fargo.
There's the scene when Steve Buscemi and his partner are pulled over, and his partner, who is a famous Scandinavian actor whose name I am blanking on.
Skarsgård.
Eric the Vampire's dad, grabs the cop, drags him into the car, and shoots him in the head, and blood gushes from the head wound.
It's not the same.
I mean, I think you say it's not the same because you see it as good filmmaking, which it is.
It's not so visceral.
So you're saying like there's no brain matter. You're not seeing
right.
But blood does gush from the wound inflicted by the gun
But we're missing an opportunity here.
Okay,
we're finally getting a barometer of Jim's gore quantity.
Oh, you're right though. Yeah.
So okay, we can quantify this now. I can figure out what I can show him and what I can't show him.
I hope that you're talking about movies.
So I'm also talking about blood, but I'll leave it up to you if you want that to be in real life or not.
That would be my own blood.
Off the table.
Terrence, are you planning an Eraserhead screening anytime?
Well, I'm thinking the sound effects alone would probably make Jim nervous. But so viscera off the table. No blood, no brain matter. But blood splat on glass, perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
And blood spray from a wood chipper while a shoe is being pushed into
a leg.
Well, mostly by the time you come into it, it's mostly, we can even give them credit for mostly being
at the knee. Blood. It starts like at the knee.
So, but nonetheless.
And it's also in the distance.
Exposed, and it's reduced to a thin spray of blood. That's acceptable for Jim. So I have to keep this in mind. So scanners. Head blowing up?
You know that I laughed at that.
Okay. We're getting.
Do you know what? I actually laughed at and loved and can watch over and over again, even though it is as gory a film as you can get. But I love it From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh yeah.
Why I can watch that, I don't know.
It's you just have a thing for the lead. What can I say? I guess everybody loves George.
He does love his pythons.
And Quentin Tarantino, and I mean Harvey Keitel.
Okay, here's the thing I love about that movie. There are many things to love about the movie, down to the final shot where they show the back of the strip club and see it's built on.
I love that.
Incan temple on the edge of a cliff, which is just like, seriously? We didn't look below the bar to see we're building
it
on. It
was brilliant.
At any rate, one of the things at the time period, Quentin Tarantino was at a point in his career where he was maximally irritating, where his ego was the most unbound, that his face was permanently locked into a sneer, and I hated him so much at that point.
Okay, excuse me, why are you using the past tense on this?
Because he has redeemed himself to me somewhat in the last day.
Oh, okay,
I don't dislike him personally as much as I do.
Dislike him personally. I saw him on Broadway.
Gotten better. I just think that the degree to which he's been empowered has just kind of eroded over the years.
Well, part of it is also, though, I sort of like the later movies a little bit better than some of the early stuff. But at any rate, also he got older. It wasn't some freaking kid being given all this damn credit for nothing, which was essentially pastiching every movie he'd ever seen. It became a guy who was older and had a little more under his belt.
Terrence, you just made me press the red button. Watch your bleeping language.
What did I just say?
I thought I heard number 3.
Is that the F one?
The F one.
Quarter in a jar.
Think so. We're in safe harbor. Go ahead and
quick question. Can we spoil Fargo, the TV series?
Well, no, because I haven't seen any of it.
Okay.
And I intend to watch it now for reasons which I'll describe. But the thing that I loved about that movie is that I got to see killed terribly not once but twice. And that made that movie for me. I got to see him have two horrible endings.
Gotcha.
So continue on to around the room.
With what I was saying, which was the TV show, the TV series Legion. Which which was in terms of a person's career, as you've been discussing Quentin Tarantino as an auteur, clearly Noah Hawley is one of the best auteurs of television today. And he established himself with the first two series of Fargo, and then with Legion, and then Fargo, series number 3, begins a week from tonight.
It does. And now, but remember by seniority, I get to go next. So I would rather.
Why don't you be the headliner?
I would rather go to the other
Jim
two
was the warm up.
Because you know the most.
Go to who?
I'd rather go to Rob and then Sam and then you.
Oh, because I can climax it.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Exactly. Because you're the one who's going at. Because you're the one sitting in a chair at home, you can climax it.
That's not
Rob, it's your turn to talk about what was connection to Legion.
Okay.
Come on, keep him going. So
Oh, and may I say, I have never, despite Chris Claremont being a friend, being a regular guest on this show or an irregular guest on this show, mm-hmm. I have never actually read Legion. I have followed a lot of Chris's career, and this is the first time in something involving the X-Men, mm-hmm. which is a minor spoiler right there, that he got big. He got credit on a small screen in big, big letters, and boy, does he deserve it.
Well, I followed Legion, I think, since he first appeared. And I really. And
when was that?
Oh, God.
Terrence, when was that?
Oh, don't ask me for dates. I don't remember dates. I just know that I've read the body of work in the
app.
I want to say 92.
Legion was well, you have to understand. Yes.
He's post-uncanny.
Yeah.
But I mean, the idea, though, I mean, like, Legion, Legion in the comic book has been there for a while, but I think the take there that they have on him is Legion in his own comic book. Because written by Claremont, by other people, mm-hmm. his powers fluctuate, but the thing about him is that he is the multiverse mutant. Depending on his personality, he will get a different abilities, usually in some way psychic, but godlike. And it does go with the psychosis. And he is an unbelievably literate kind of character, like Deadpool. You can put him in anything. You know, you wrap an aesthetic all around him. And the comic book, which is just about Legion, that's the one that takes a more artistic and different aesthetic than the other regular mainstream comics, because it's not very often you see people in costume in Legion as he's doing other X-Men films and other X-Men comics. And they kind of that kind of rolled into, I think, the show, too. It can be its own thing because the story was its own thing. The art
and that was my like point, is that as a non-reader of the comic book, mm-hmm. And I knew only that it was related to the comic books after I'd watched like episode 3 and got on the phone with Terrence, and he's telling me the entire history of every episode and all that. So I went to Wikipedia and found out way too many spoilers by looking up Legion comics as opposed to Legion television.
Well, it didn't spoil it for me.
I figured out who the main villain was in the second episode, and I turned to my coworker. I said, "So it's can I spoil it?
Everyone, yeah."
I said,
Hang on. Okay, at this point, we're going to be discussing Legion at great length. Anyone listening needs to know, if you haven't watched it all the way through and don't want to get anything, stop listening for the next 20 minutes and come back. Because at least for that time, we want to be able to discuss this at great depth because it deserves it.
I would say that
if you haven't watched it yet, this is going to
as a person who had it spoiled before I saw episode 3, it did not diminish my pleasure.
No, but
I pick up your minds.
People. I figured out who it was, who the villain was, who Shadow King was. It was episode 2, and I went to my coworker who had already finished it. I said, "So it's Shadow King, right?" He looked me dead in the face and said, "No. It's not him." It's like, it's not him. I was like, fine. I'll wait until I get to the end. So I started thinking maybe it might be it's Cassandra Nova or somebody else, but he just was messing with me. So Sam, what was your take?
Well, first, what's your relationship? How familiar were you with?
He read all the comics.
No, I haven't. I've read some of them, although.
I'm sorry. You were talking to Sam. I'm sorry. I thought you were asking Rob that you'd missed it. Go on. Sorry, Sam.
I don't have much to add from what Cam said, except to say, and this is kind of skipping over, is that most of how I conceive of Legion revolves around his kind of childhood persona. Mm. And. I think to a certain extent, I mean, certainly that's a component of the show, but I think Dan Stevens' performance really contextualizes it in such a way that it didn't feel to me when I was watching the show that I was just getting a rehash of mm-hmm. of Legion. Although, to be fair, I don't think I had an extensive a read of it as Cam did.
Okay, now, without question, so I'm the one who had really no comic book context, although I understood that it tied into X-Men, that there were genetic connections between characters in the X-Men universe and people in the Legion universe that crossover. In the form of an X. We're talking about crossover. Well, it's X-Men. So it is told very subtly, and as a person who I'm very familiar and pleased with most of the X-Men movies, although I have not seen, I will eventually see, but I have not yet seen Logan. I'm waiting for it to appear on the small screen so that I can be a little bit more selective about certain scenes involving impalement.
That's going to be like 80% of the movie, so...
No. There are basically two scenes in the film that are problematic.
For you?
For me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Probably more than that, probably.
Possibly. I've seen other movies by James Mangold. I have a pretty good idea how he works and what he does.
Mangold? I didn't even realize his name is Mangold.
I hurt myself today.
It's a fellow who merely wrote and directed it, but what does writing and directing a movie have to do with anything, huh? Okay, so there are a lot of people who still don't, you know, the author, the director, or whatever, these things don't matter to them. I am a big believer in auteur theory, which almost pretty much isn't a theory anymore. There are some movies that are made without it, and there's a word for them, bad. Generally, those are movies by committee, and if it doesn't have one person's imprimatur upon it, it doesn't always have to be the director, for example.
Well, I am easier on the studio system than most.
Well, you've worked
functioned. It functioned well. No, I've never gotten to the big studio levels. My one encounter with Disney was horrific. But I mean, the bottom line is that at its best, the studio system can turn out a good movie. Galaxy Quest to me is an example of a good studio picture. I don't see that as being an auteur's film. I may be wrong, but I saw it as a good commercial film that was brilliantly done and hit all the marks because everyone did their job right and the executives didn't screw up the script. But for the most part, at the point you hit over $100 million in a budget, the studio system is going to screw up the picture. I was not as happy with Logan as the reviewers. I found a lot of it to be fairly standard rote, you know.
Really?
Plot. And it just sort of trots through its little bag of tricks, and there's not an unpredictable moment in it down to – there was one surprise, and that I give them credit for. But other than that, it was like pretty much business.
Legion.
No. Let's get back to Legion.
Logan,
yes.
Lagoon.
We could cover all these grounds. Logan from the Black Lagoon. We could do variations all night.
Oh, I like Logan from the Black Lagoon.
Okay.
I meant you, but I was going to say, can we – sorry, yeah, yeah, sorry. Can we talk about Logan without – ruining them? You just want us to skip.
Well, we're in a spoiler zone.
We're in a spoiler area. Until at least 2 o'clock New York time.
Okay.
Next 18 minutes, understand she's a guy.
Your dreams may be shared.
Okay, she's a guy, which is, yeah, for those who don't remember The Crying Game, that was probably the biggest spoiler of all time was she's a guy. So one time David Letterman goes on TV and started his monologue by saying, she's a guy. There, I've done it.
What is it?
Van Horn's a man.
So,
no, Pet Detective.
You were about to say,
yeah, thank you.
Cam, Rob?
I don't know. I lost my train of thought there.
You're going to ruin Logan.
You wanted to know if you could talk spoiler free about Logan.
You know, when Logan stabs Han Solo through the chest.
Logan stabbed first for sure.
Mm. And then he ran. That was Logan's. Anyway.
I lost my train of thought. We went off on a tangent.
Terrence and I caught that little grenade that Jim tossed out.
It was
there.
A little too
that
obvious.
Was so
it was
painful.
A little too obvious.
Well, the thing is that Logan takes place in a society where once you reach the age of 300, they hunt you down because you've gotten too old. So
there
which
you
is
go,
exactly
there
what
go.
Happened to Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, yeah.
So the geriatric games.
Was that why his claws weren't coming out? Because the stone turning blue or red or whatever it was getting in the way?
With age,
one serious spoiler in Logan that we should probably avoid.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
There is one serious spoiler.
And
I think
everybody
here knows what it is.
Yeah.
And I haven't even seen the movie.
Get it? I could number it. You know what I'm
talking about? Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to Legion. Because we're going to get out of the spoiler zone. I don't want people coming back in and going, you lied to us. Okay, so Legion I first ran into as a character when I got the Marvel Unlimited app. I wish DC and Vertigo and all these comics would do the same thing. Having the back catalog of a comic company is an unbelievable experience. And every week they put up the new stuff, newer stuff. I think at this point the new stuff is about 2-3 months behind, if not a little bit more. What's on the stands, which is great because they have time to sell the paper issues and then, you know, I can keep up with things. But what it's done over the last 3-4 years that I've had it, besides killing my reading of any books that I'm not reviewing, is that it's allowed me to understand the nature of comics as a chronal medium. That chronal's not quite the right word, but we're talking about story over increasingly long lengths of time. So we've got characters that were created when we were children, or in some cases before we were born, who are following, who've been written for so long and gone through so many variations that the combined experience of these characters begins to approximate that of an actual life, because they've gone through so much and we've shared it with them. Mm-hmm. So in the last review I did for the Fantastic Stories, I was pointing this out because it was kind of an epiphany. It made me understand more of some of the anger of people when their favorite comic book characters are changed for whatever reason, to gay or to black or to whatever, because they've literally grown up with these people for 20, 30 years of their lives. Legion is a character that came up in a small way, and I am reading everything on the app out of sequence, so I'm not always sure what precedes what. My perception of Legion was that he came up as a sort of backstory, small thing, and over the decades he's expanded. So there actually were some Legion standalone comics, some remarkable ones. But the basis of Legion was that he was the child of Charles Xavier and Gabriel Haller. They'd had a
Who is Gabriel Haller?
I have to check. She predated Moira.
She predates Moira.
In his life. She was someone he met when he was young. He was traveling the world. He was in his 20s. It's at the same time period that he meets the Shadow King and defeats him. And the encounter with the Shadow King is just like a one-off quick comic. The Shadow King sort of returns because it turns out he isn't quite killed, but he's an evil telepath. Yeah. And what they've done in Legion is to adapt threads from different strands of the Legion quantity of material available, which has evolved over time, as Rob pointed out, because different writers bring up different aspects. The core of David Haller was always that he was a super-powered mutant whose powers went beyond exceeding Xavier's telepathy. It went into the actual ability to reshape reality itself. But one of the factors that came into play, which I believe will come into play in the series, based on certain shots where he's being attacked by a crowd of people that aren't in the asylum, he's just being attacked by a crowd of disparate people, is that David actually is schizophrenic. Not schizophrenic classically. He's actually a multiple personality. Yes. All of the damage done to him did indeed divide him. And in the particular, in the standalone comics with David, he essentially in his head is trapped in an asylum with hundreds of altars, each mm-hmm. of which has an individual power.
There is a lovely scene at the end of maybe episode 3 or something that just shows this entire crowd.
Exactly.
It's the closing shot.
They showed that shot actually in the beginning, like in the top, first right. intro scenes.
Right. Okay, well, let's tell people what the shot is.
It's a shot of David in a room, and like he just
David Haller, aka Legion,
and suddenly this crowd of people just are all lunging at him, arms extended, grabbing at him, and he's buried beneath this pile of humans.
And each one is shouting at him, demanding his attention. No, it's me.
I.e., dominance in my mind is what it is, because the thing is at various points. What happens with the Shadow King? I went back into the app and I started digging up Shadow King and just searching for him. He pops up in the background of another storyline in the X-Men, where essentially while the X-Men are battling one evil, he has taken over David on the island that Moira is in and runs. I can't remember the name of it right now. And is essentially going through the altars and pulling up their different powers and manifesting them all and using them to screw with reality. And after, I imagine, the X-Men deal with the main thing that they're dealing with, they go and they deal with him. And that happens a couple of times throughout story, where David comes up, does something amazingly big, huge, and then they all get together. But when he did his standalone comic, it was fascinating because he essentially has learned to manage his alters and essentially has them all locked into little rooms. And as he needs abilities, he goes and grabs the altar with that ability.
It's a kind of prosthetic. So it's actually a device that they created for him, that Xavier created for him, so he can kind of dial in on a particular ability.
You mean the Shadow King?
No.
David
himself. Oh, David. Okay.
Legion himself. He's called Legion because he is indeed multiple personalities.
Yes,
and multiple
he contains legions.
Because the biblical phrase is, "My name is Legion."
Well, because that was a possession case. And that applies certainly to David. There's an analogy of possession, demonic possession, in the fact that these are violent figures. At certain points in the story, five of them get out of his body and manifest in the real world, and he and the X-Men have to track them down, and he has to reabsorb them, you know, like Jamie the absorbing the multiple man, you know, taking his alters in. But it's a fascinating premise. It's been carried to a large degree in the comics. They've gone very big with it. They've gone very small with it. And what I see in the TV series is a very good ability to understand the essence of what his storyline is about and to create a new story around it that doesn't directly reflect any of the storylines in the comics, but stays very true to what I think Chris and the co-creator of Legion had in mind when they began. I see a lot of Chris in this.
Chris Claremont is who we're discussing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm not as familiar with the other person being credited with the work on Legion that has led.
But he's the artist, obviously.
Well, not obviously, but that would make sense. But
it's the way that comics credits work.
It's truly based on the Claremont line of stories with one artist, then that makes sense, and I'll look that up.
But it's the way that Chris works, okay?
Sam's trying to jump in.
Thing is that other people have...
Okay, let's let Sam get a word in here.
No, Terrence, go ahead and finish.
Well, I was just going to say, there have been other writers doing stories about Legion other than Chris. He has not been... I mean, my understanding is that other comics have been taken on by other writers who are building on his work. What were you going to say, Sam?
Oh, I was going to say that if we consider how Legion fits into just, if we're to depart from comics for a second and think about cinematic and TV, not just heroes, but superheroes, I mean, and let's just even further restrict that.
Point of information, he was created by Chris Claremont and John Byrne in Uncanny X-Men 117. I just knew that off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Wikipedia. Go on.
But is Byrne who's being credited on the show credits? I don't think so.
No, he is not. I think it's not.
One of the other writers.
I'm telling you
comics.
Who created him in the comic, Sam!
I was just going to say that if we even limit it to DC and Marvel characters, and we'll rope in some Vertigo characters too, represented on TV and movies, I think where Legion takes us in an interesting direction is that for a lot of these narratives, and there obviously are some exceptions. I mean, I think that the Joker from The Dark Knight is the one that jumps out, but that villains are often the weak link of the story, and largely because villains can't quite operate at the level of the heroes do in terms of their sheer destructive power because, well, then you've got a world that doesn't survive. So
this is also something that goes back to Shakespeare, that the better the villain, the better the show.
Right, but I think...
And Hitchcock, et cetera, yeah.
But what makes Legion as a show, I think, very effective is this is essentially, you know, a villain that... I mean, if we're to forget the humans involved in the villainy, that can't be beaten, at least not within the terms the show has provided so far, that essentially David's demons are his demons, and they ain't going nowhere.
By the way,
I think that
Aubrey... Well, technically, they're actually headed south right now.
yes, right.
I would disagree with you on that. I would agree. Well, the Shadow King, I think, is the problem with intangible evil. Is how do you pin it down and put a stake through its heart if you can't even physically touch it? That's the nature of what we're dealing with in this, with Lenny as an expression of the Shadow King. And ultimately, I think they do have to find a way to put him down. But the irony, of course, is that they thought he was dead, and he just hidden David's body and mind and grew up mm-hmm. with him as a dog and then as a friend and then as Lenny. You know, so he tracks this kid's life and shapes him. And that's one of the
– And I think Aubrey Plaza's performance
– Oh, my God. You never talk enough about that.
Right.
She – I mean, there are some good performances in there, but Aubrey – Plaza steals that show.
Mm-hmm. I said it the other day at we were someplace. I've seen her, and I've been following her for years. I've always enjoyed her work. This has given her an opportunity to do something with her abilities that no one has had a chance to literally do. Yeah. There has not been a character like this that I can really pinpoint. I mean, there have been evil characters that allow an actor to, like, go, I mean, from, Clarice, you know, I'm blocking his name. I'm so excited about Aubrey.
Anthony Hopkins?
Yes. I mean, Hopkins got to create a classic villain. You know, many actors have gotten to create classic villains. Nothing has ever covered the textural range of what she's doing in this series. Now, I want to get to that because one of the things, yes, the villains, the structure of this, I would go on record as saying that in my mind, this has been the most successful inspired by adaptation of a comic to a TV series that has been done so far. Because
you would hold that up against Luke Cage, Jessica Jones.
I haven't seen
Luke Cage was fabulous. This is better.
Yes.
I haven't seen Luke Cage. I would hold it up against Jessica Jones so far.
I mean, like,
I certainly would put it up against any of the DC things that I'm really hating right now.
Yeah, no,
but
no,
the
no
thing is that what I love about it is that it's doing many, many things. Not only is it a brilliantly literary adaptation from one medium to another, it is also one of the most exciting uses of the new television medium that we have with the capacity to do the things we have. Dually, not just from a point of view of the digital capacity to change physical reality and do things, which they've certainly used to enormous advantage in this show, but even just conceptually in the writing, it's to the point where you can basically have three people walk into a doorway, watch a small child in the room with somebody else having an interaction, and because you have said, one of us is a mutant who can go into people's memories, and that's what this is now, is us in his memories. That's pure conceptual effect. And the show blends between hard effects, magic,
just like a mole on a beautiful person, though, I think we have to acknowledge. The dialogue has clunk to it. I mean, it's clunk.
The fact of...
most of it I like.
The fact of the matter is that Noah Hawley is the star here. This is a show, and this is rare, where you have a TV show with an auteur, okay? But Noah Hawley, in taking Fargo and going new places with it in a way that people did not imagine with TV, his writing of Legion, now understand it's not just that what happened in this episode and what happened in that episode. The series is not really structured that way. It is structured rather to reveal pieces of information at you on an ongoing basis so that in the manner of a mosaic, it unfolds and you start being able to discern what the storyline is as pieces of the puzzle get filled in.
They show you basically the entire plot in episode one, and then they expand from there.
Except you don't understand it. The beauty of it is that they're starting for the perceptions of a character who they're telling you is mentally impaired. And I would defend the nature of the dialogue as being the sort of fragmented communication that we are expressing from David at the beginning. It occasionally is comic book clunky, and I kind of even like that, but because it keeps that pulp quality to it, because the visual language is so insanely rich that the dialogue can almost fall flat at times, because it at times becomes almost peripheral. The thing that I find interesting also in the visuals, the Times Reviewer described it as Stanley Kubrick in the 60s, Stanley Kubrick at the period of Clockwork Orange directing The Prisoner. And there are beautiful visual references to so many things in this show. One of them is the funny thing about mentioning The Prisoner was a knee-jerk review comment, because in the first couple episodes that he's in the institution, Clockwork, Kubrick, He's wearing a black pajamas with white piping, which are identical to the outfits they wear in The Prisoner. So there's the little visual references to culture, the culture of the genre, as well as everything else in this as well. But I see it more as early David Cronenberg. It's so redolent of the style and the intelligence and the psychiatric perversity of The Brood and Scanners. But,
it is also Lynch. It is also
there's a touch of Lynch, more Cronenberg, who's more rational than Lynch and has the sleekness of the color.
Well put.
That Kubrick has.
But I don't. In Clockwork Orange. I don't know if the audience is as has the knowledge and the experience the back of you guys are going into. I think what Legion does is it takes this level of artistic, gosh, I don't even know what you would call
arsenal.
And it brings it back to 20-somethings who aren't into musical theater they bring musical theater into it.
It all starts with Sid Barrett.
Yeah. Well, what I was saying is like this is new. I look at this as a milestone when it comes to comic book movies, or just bring style back into something that just tends to be looked at as something that's somewhat juvenile. Even now you're just starting to have X-Men comic book films, which you can now do rated R. Rated R means that you can go with more blood and more gore, but also you can take a look at certain ideas and themes that you can't do very well in PG-13. That's what I think they're doing with this, is not feel like an X-Men movie, even though the outlandish weird things are happening, even though nobody's in costume, right?
Actually, Legion is in costume.
No. He has the icon, but that's not costume like Spanish. Like, if you go to an X-Men movie.
Well, just actually in X-Men in the movies, you don't see Wolverine. He refuses to wear the costume.
No, their costume is black leather. But in the next movie, though, the X-Men are going to be in costume.
They're not in street clothes.
Yeah, the majority of X-Men movies.
The bottom line is he's not a skin tight superhero.
Although Jermaine, I know that's not his character's name, but he's just going to be Jermaine to me. He's got a superhero outfit of sorts.
And what I will say is all of this X-Men talk, and this is my point as somebody who comes into it without knowing this facet of Chris's work.
Care.
I know his prose, yeah, it doesn't matter. It's a brilliant television show. It's a brilliant story that totally stands on its own two feet. And if you know the other references, the movie references that of all the various people, and the comic references, it still works.
You know, what I'm saying is
a cam is something to say.
My only question going forward is how do they handle Legion psychosis, because he actually does legitimately have one. In the comic book, it's dissociative disorder, which is they're not really sure how real that is. So what do they actually give him? What is that going to say about the psychology in general, you know, mental disorder? I don't know what it's going
to
do.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think we have to wait and see. I mean, the reality is halfway through the 8 episodes, they're acting like, you were never schizophrenic. You just had amazing powers. And he's justifiably dubious about that because he knows what's going on in his head.
I think that
evolves in the second season as part of what Noah's trying to do.
There was a very good article in the Times that made the reference to the current spate of unreliable narrator stories that we've been having that were sort of launched with Fight Club, brought to television with Mr. Robot, and then continue with the unreliable narrators. It's so that at the end, it was JR didn't die. It was all a dream and stuff like that. What they do in Legion is they start out by saying nobody in this room is reliable.
Right. And the thing is, I love the details,
but the details of the show do kind of paint a very specific picture.
They end up doing that when you are paying attention. And this, by the way, is my one big complaint about the series. And somebody, I think it was Rob, made reference to it earlier, is the way in which it plays out is that so many shows are brought to us now streaming. Jessica Jones released in one day, Luke Cage in one day, and then you go on your schedule. You watch two episodes tonight, one episode next week, three episodes in within 2 days going on. You choose the timing. Legion is on the old one episode a week basis. And I feel that I would have appreciated the show and pieced together all of the clues within the show better. And remember, I'm somebody who's coming into this not knowing all of the backstory here. I would rather, I don't want to say binged it, but I would rather have watched the entire series. Have.
Yeah, I mean, devil's advocate here. I mean, all you got to do is just wait until.
Well, that's the deal. That's why
I would say anyone sitting through all 8 hours back to back is going to have their brain.
No. Binging doesn't have to be done back to back. You can watch an 8-episode series in 2 weeks.
But people will watch it in a day. I'm just saying.
I won't. And I was going to say, people, by the way,
you know, it's like,
and this
you know,
is advice to people
smart.
On your next Noah Hawley show, which begins
but
next
the other
Wednesday.
Thing is that's like,
I'm going to finish this. On the next Noah Hawley show that begins next Wednesday, called Fargo Series 3, I heartily recommend that you record it. And maybe after about episode number 6, it's 8 episodes long, start watching it at your own pace.
Well, I really, the thing I have to say is I love the movie Fargo, foot and all. I did not watch the TV series the first season just because I think I was watching other stuff and working and didn't have time to add another, like, series. And I was a little dubious as to milking the cow beyond its capacity to milk. But having looked at Legion and looking at the trailers during it for season 3 of Fargo, which they were very smart to do, I'm going back to season 1 before I go to season 3 and watching the first two.
Although
because season
are...
2, the trailers look really good. But again, it was like, I got 500 other things to watch. But now, after Legion, the only reason I bring up what I see as the media roots of Legion is not that that needs to be known at all to be appreciated, but for those of us who recognize where he's doing what he's doing and where it's coming from, here's someone who really knows what he's doing. And he is building something that certainly anyone walking in could enjoy and appreciate without having to know all the precedents. Like, you know, you can watch La La Land without having seen every 40s musical ever made. But he's done much better than La La Land in that he's done better than La La Land in that he's taken the language of those earlier artists, Kubrick, Cronenberg, all these people who did this medium in the way smart, intelligent. Ken Russell, I mean, Altered States.
Yes.
You know, all of these things, he's building on a body of work that I've always loved, which almost guarantees that I love this, but I see the influence on it and understand that at the same time, he's bringing an aesthetic to an audience that may not have recognized the earlier works. And it's great. Okay. So I'm definitely going to be going back and watching Fargo 1 now. It's like, God damn it, now I've got to watch 3 seasons.
What I was saying just before is, really, this is, it's a love letter to genre and to style, really.
Yeah.
Really is what it is. So it's saying, like you see...
Everybody watch me nod.
Yeah. I mean it's... I'm gonna take this to hip-hop for a second. So there's this new thing called mumble hip-hop. And it's just, it's so...
Really? Ridiculous. I thought that's what we were doing
it's
for the last
so
20 years.
It's so ridiculous, and it's on purpose. And they're not connected to any previous style or any... Or any roots in any production. It's just something new that's just trying to be like, it's like a YouTube phenomenon. It's weird. Like, hopefully it doesn't last any longer. But it's not connected to anything, in the same way that Legion is connected to all these different styles that you talked about. Mm-hmm. That there were years of curation of artists and directors who took this and made it something that is refined. Sam, you want to say something?
Hmm.
Okay.
No, I was listening.
It was profound, Sam.
I was listening to what Cam says, and yeah. I mean, I think that one thing that I think is just undisputable is that as a TV show, just I mean, outside the conversation of superhero shows, I mean, it is just visually stunning and inventive in ways that transcend, I think, the genre and also transcend the budget. I mean, that not all the moments are just them throwing money and saying, make this look that just the decision to film a certain scene upside down at a particular moment was an incredibly powerful moment. And that's literally as cheap as filming it right side up. I mean, there's the
and also just even the scenic design, those bizarre cells that Section 3, is it, had his sister and the other guy locked in. It's like, what the hell is that? Why are you having a 10-foot, 45-degree angle slope with a little 3-foot slab at the top and glass walls? Who builds a cell like that? Who are these lunatics? It's there's beautiful things, off-putting visual things like that that just disorient you in an odd way. You're disturbed without understanding what it is that's disturbing you. And it's great. It's great.
Can we talk about time for a second? I mean, does the show tell us definitively when is all this happening?
Yeah, I mean, they're talking about emails.
Yeah, they're talking about emails, and yet it looks like they're in, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know.
It looks 21st century to me, where particularly, I think we can drift a bit. But to me, it feels, it's, the reason I bring up Cronenberg is that it is as much a part of our present as The Brood was a part of his present. Okay. He made The Brood in the 70s, but when you look at it, there's this oddly non-time because of the locations he picks, the settings, the style of the buildings. Mm-hmm. There's a futurist element without being futuristic. Mm-hmm. So it takes it out. It's Clockwork Orange to me does the same thing. These things transcend any specific time. They become literally simply contemporary. If you look at Clockwork Orange, it seems like it could be happening now, though, because it isn't really the 70s looking. It isn't really 80s looking.
And I guess
it created
X-Men,
its own aesthetic that makes it contemporary whenever you watch.
And X-Men gives us that luxury to a certain extent, since all the X-Men that happen in cinema happen sometime in the sort of future, you know?
The vague comic future, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and the only real distinction between their world and our world is they've got better toys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, everyone else in X-Man world seems to just be walking around with cell phones. They have private planes and other little devices, which isn't the comics as well. I mean, the comics are very much in a present day, but they've got better tech.
Yeah. No, there's one scene I just want to go back to. It was one of my favorite scenes I kept on replaying over and over again in Hulu. One of those things that is not a high budget. It's the, I think it's episode 6 or episode 7, where they walk into the house and it's everything's on mute. And there's one scene where Carrie walks in, and I forget the name of the woman, like the Professor Rex, Miss Bird. She's pointing at Carrie, and she's saying, "I want Carrie," and the male Carrie's like, "No," and the male Carrie is saying, "No, I want Carrie, no." And the camera's going back and forth, and suddenly the music turns up, and you turn the camera back from Mrs. Bird to Carrie. And the Carrie likes action. The Carrie, he's ready to go, ready to fight. She's there with a spiked baseball bat, and the bass drops. Boom. It's like, yes, now we can go. Mm-hmm. I think I replayed that scene over and over and over.
No, that was nice. That was remarkable. Because it was like you were like, what's psycho going Tom Waits here? You know?
And then, boom.
I loved, you know, Dr. Bird's going, oh, what's her name? Amanda, just before he's taken over by Lenny. I mean, it was like, no, she's finally going to get her spit back.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
he's like walking out the door. I mean, they're just lovely little things. Yeah. They're, oh, one of my favorite things. Okay, so first of all, totally did not recognize him from the Concords. I've seen that guy.
It's Britton Jermaine.
I literally saw none of the voice, which is everywhere because his voice is the voice of the computer and every machine in the center before the character is even introduced. But the physical transformation from what I know of him to that is staggering. But what was very funny was after Oliver Bird was introduced, the second or third week after I saw him, I'm watching Kolchak the Night Stalker, which they put back on MeTV. And I've seen pretty much everyone, but there's a couple I haven't seen. And I was watching an episode, and Severin Darden was in it. And
Yay.
Severin Darden was everywhere in the 70s and the 60s. He was on everything. He was in the
plant. And he was a regular acting member of Troop at WBAI. He was.
I'm sure he was. He had a great voice. He was everywhere on TV. He had and I looked at him, and he's groomed and dressed exactly like Oliver Bird. Oliver Bird plays like Severin Darden. Again, it's another weird cultural reference.
I can see
it's a pure character actor
I'm
who
glad
fit into that genre at a certain period that this character supposedly lost in because he went into the box at that in that time period. I'm listening to music from the 60s and everything. It's
so glad you got all that. All I could see was Jermaine.
Well, I was writing a piece about it. I started talking about it. And I was like, oh, I've got to see who this actor is because I've got to mention his name. I was putting it on Facebook, writing about it. I was putting it on Facebook because I wanted to mention how much I was enjoying the show. And I looked it up and I literally just, my jaw dropped. It was like, you're kidding me. I almost used an S word. That, no. Really? That's, oh my God. And you know, I'm flipping through the mental index and playing his voice from here and over here and going, oh my God, that's the most amazing performance. I can't believe that's him.
What are the chances of the film totally doing Severn Darden for season two?
None.
What?
No?
None.
What's that?
He has offered his availability. And people have asked, will either Patrick Stewart or James McAvoy be in season two? And Noah Hawley said, that's not the direction we're going in.
And it shouldn't.
However, it shouldn't. There is a rumor, and it's only rumor, and the only thing that helps this rumor is the fact that it has not been disclaimed, is that there could be some Deadpool.
What? Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense, per se.
Oh, wait, no, wait. It can if it's not
the universe.
Not the movie Deadpool.
Yeah, if this is a different
there
Deadpool.
There is other Deadpool. What? Oh, come on. No, okay, look. I'm sorry. Keep your damned hands off Deadpool.
Based on the work of Chris Claremont and Bill Sienkiewicz, by the way, mm-hmm. is the name of the artist who worked on the adaptation of Legion that was on TV. I don't know, but you know, this is this is up to Noah Hawley.
Until this moment, I didn't realize I wanted it, but I want someone to create a satire of Legion that's Squirrel Girl, her coming to grips with the squirrels in her life, and in the same cinematic style.
Which would be amusing, except that she's the most relentlessly self-fulfilled character in
all. Well, yeah,
she's the only character with no doubt. Okay, I thought it was a joke when she was babysitting.
I'm giving Legion talk 3 minutes. Go on.
I thought that Squirrel Girl was created as a joke when she was babysitter. So my first introduction was her. She was babysitter for Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. They had a baby.
That's right.
They were living in Avengers Mansion. They needed someone to take care of the kid who could defend the kid if need be. And Squirrel Girl ended up being the babysitter. They do a whole comic issue of interviews with all these various. It was a riot.
I think you'll find that the TV series version of Luke Cage goes a little bit differently.
Yes, I'm sure. But then I found out, oh, no, she's been around. They're not kidding. This is really a girl who talks to squirrels and has a tail.
Yeah.
And her own comic is a riot. I mean, she's getting a movie, evidently.
She's not getting a movie. She's getting a TV show, sort of, that she is going to be the leader of the new Defenders, and it's going to come out on Freeform, which for TV audiences, the Fosters
is ABC.
And
Disney,
it was the Disney Family Channel.
I couldn't.
Now is she going to be played by the?
It can't be a serious.
I mean,
It should be humorous. I mean, my God, it's Squirrel Girl, and the comic is
defined
very
serious.
She beat Dr. Doom by therapizing
him. Her first time out, she beats Dr. Doom. But I think Squirrel Girl and the possibility of her adaptation really speaks to, I think, the spine that will not break of the Marvel Cinematic and TV Universe, that comics are cheap to make, that you can make so many of them, and that's what part of what we love about them is that there are just oceans of comics with characters we know that we can immerse ourselves into.
But movies, many of them can be bad.
Well, sure.
And are.
Sure. But
look at DC.
Sure. But what I'm saying is that movies are expensive. And because they won't have Infinity War, since Squirrel Girl won't beat Thanos in Infinity War, Squirrel Girl can't be as realized as the character's supposed to be. Because if you are making a million and one comics, sure. There's no reason why Squirrel Girl shouldn't beat Thanos, but since they can't use any minutes of a movie, to say nothing of like make it the climax of the movie to have Squirrel Girl beat Thanos, the two just don't line up.
Yeah,
I think that's the central spine of cinematic superhero movies.
The MCU is distinct from the ABC Marvel Universe, which is distinct from the Netflix, which is distinct from the FXX.
But all of that is a contract. Even so, superheroes... You can negotiate characters.
Yes, you can.
I'm thinking the reality is that TV shows are easier to make in the modern technology than movies. And that, yeah, you may not make a movie out of a character like Squirrel Girl, but you could give her a series easily. Because you can do 8 episodes and afford that in a reasonable way.
What I meant to say is that essentially there is a dimension of superhero persona that can exist in comics, and that because of, I would argue, primarily financial and, let's be honest, logistical constraints that neither TV nor film can live up to, and there's always going to be that schism.
Although there are something like this, though, you could do in like YouTube four minute shots, like there are minisodes.
Mm. Well, I'm agreeing with Sam in terms of the limitations. What I'm thinking is only that, I mean, essentially, Squirrel Girl beats Galactus in a park. She doesn't do it with the city being. I mean, there was very little effects needed. It was like a guy in a Galactus suit, you know, and a green screen. And that's the good thing about Squirrel Girl. That's also the good thing about the Marvel Universe, is that there's an amazing range within it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've read issues of, like, the new Spider-Man, you know, now that we've collapsed all the multiverses and Miguel is now living in the same world as Peter Parker, who has a corporation, you know. And there are a lot of comics where it's, like, dealing with home issues and stuff that doesn't require too terribly much. And that, I think, is also what Jennifer Jones proved. I mean, they did a Netflix original series around Jessica Jones. You know, Jennifer Jones, someone else entirely. And it worked. I mean, because a lot of it's cinematography, a lot of it's, you know, shooting in good direction, and direction's gotten better because our directors grew up knowing how movies get made.
Was a dimension of Jessica Jones that I kind of thought was interesting, that the fact that X-Men and Jessica Jones exist sort of in the same universe is that...
Don't tell that to the lawyers.
Yeah, of course. But the Purple Man's powers are meant to be a metaphorical stand-in for his evil, that the fact that he can do what he can do is itself wrong, that his powers are wrong. The fact that he can take away people's free will and control them and make them do what he wants, whether they want to or not, is wrong. But the Purple Man's powers are not fundamentally different from Charles Xavier's.
Now, I by the way, that's true. I never thought of that, but it's absolutely
true.
Except
he's verbal, and Xavier is telepathic.
Now, I am not putting a total quash on this conversation, but I'm going to point out that we have half an hour left of a two-hour show, because there's going to be outro music and stuff like that. So we have other less pressing agendas. We've already met two, one of which was Legion, the other which was Fargo, which we've taken as far as we need to, because it'll just be interesting to see Fargo 3. I will mention, by the way, that it is really unnecessary, I'm certain, to see Fargo 1 and 2. If you want to do it in that order, that's fine.
He seems to do them standalone.
You will find there is connective tissue, even though Fargo 2 takes place 30 years before Fargo 1, and a lead woman in Fargo 1 is a little girl in Fargo 2. That's the only character crossover. Oh, no, I take it back. There's a young version of a person who's played by Keith Carradine in Fargo 1. And then there is the one thing of connective tissue that we will find in all versions of Fargo, from the movie through the 3 series, that we are promised. There will be a suitcase full of money. And how it turns up. What I'm really annoyed about, though, is that they killed, I shouldn't say.
Thank you.
Let's just say... How do I put it? No. It has to be done. I was not familiar with Key and Peele until Fargo 2. And
they kill one of them?
I'm not going to say.
That sort of intimates that one of them is going to get killed.
For all you know, they killed somebody else.
But they were in it?
They're major characters.
In the second one?
In Fargo 2, yes.
Now, how is 3 connecting to 1 and 2? Is it after 1? So it's like one, back in the past for two, then we go back to after one for three? Do you know?
I know Zip.
Okay.
I know that it's created, written, and directed by Noah Hawley. And let's see. And I can we can look up on IMDb. And I will do that right now.
Oh, we can have a race.
Yeah, exactly. That's a 2014 TV series. IMDb. Oh, yeah, I have to click on more title matches. So I'm looking for Fargo.
Fargo TV series Wikipedia. Let's get all the non-facts.
Well, I'm on
Let's
IMDb, see. So you can do Wikipedia.
Ten episode limited series. Billy Bob Thornton. No, that's season.
That's one.
Two.
No, that's season one. If Billy Bob Thornton is in it, it's season one.
Well, wasn't he in the last season? Martin Freeman.
No.
Okay, hang on. Let's see. Season one.
In any case, I believe we started this line of inquiry with the assertion that, there was nothing more.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
They were running out of time.
Thank you, Sam.
Stop talking and go web surfing for.
Okay. So speaking of the purple people eater.
Oh, it's 2010. Sorry.
Speaking of the purple people eater in Jessica Jones, who am I referring to?
David Tennant, the 10th Doctor, which brings us to Doctor Who.
Who? And what we will say about Doctor Who is...
Why wasn't Who on first?
You asked for it. You asked for it.
I did. I really did.
That was a good even for the pun you did at the beginning, so... Consider yourself myself avenged.
Yeah, okay. The invention. Geez, here we go again. That's a Fargo reference. The here Doctor. Is the totality of what I know about the next season of Doctor Who, and boy, will this really get you. Start Saturday. Okay, so I'm more interested in discussing what happens after Doctor Who. Doctor Who is on Saturday on BBC America at 9 p.m. At 10 p.m.,
Class.
Now, I have seen all of Class. Terrence has seen half of it. Our other people here have seen none of it. And the obvious question is this going to be like Sarah Jane Adventures?
I could answer that.
Yeah, please do.
Only if no the two boys in Sarah Jane's Adventure started making out.
That's based on, okay, so, camera and nude.
So we'll, on camera and nude. I mean, they went a lot farther than the audience for Sarah Jane in the first episode alone.
So will it be more of a Torchwood type situation?
Yes.
Well, Jim says yes. Having watched all of Torchwood and still being in therapy for it, I would say not quite so severe.
No, he said...
There are actual survivors in this series, yeah. Which they certainly didn't have by the end of season one of Torchwood, except for Jack and the woman who came in at the last minute. So it's an older group. First of all, they're in high school, though they all look like they're college age. That's life and TV. But it is darker, definitely, than Sarah Jane. It's an interesting spinoff because it's not actually. I mean, it's sort of like, remember that school we kept going back to in the Doctor Who series? Well,
it's where Clarence
series set in it.
So, I mean, without spoiling too much or anything, walk me through how they exist in the Hooniverse.
Like, okay, I can do that fairly simply. Easy, yes. Cam, would you like one of these? Oh, no, you're teaching in the morning. How about a bit of sugar contained with a peel?
I'm on spring break, buddy.
You're on. Oh, I didn't
realize. No, they're off this week. It's spring break.
Oh, good God.
For the record, NYU is not off.
And by the way, speaking of a break, this is WBAI in New York City. But the answer to the question is a simple one. It's not that simple, but here it is. In the first episode, not very long into class, at the Coal Hill School, there is a plaque in the front of the school. It's been rebuilt, the school, that is to say, very much in the same way that Somerville high school, whatever, Sunnydale, whatever went to.
Yes.
There's a plaque in the hallway that says, that cites the people who have died who were involved with the school. And you will see three names on there. And one of them is Clara.
Okay.
Why am I blanking on her last name for a moment? Clara Bow? No, not Clara Bow. Danny Pink.
Okay.
Is another, the math teacher.
Oh, it's their school. Okay, it's Clara and Danny's school.
And, all right. And
but who's the third name?
And there's a third name. Terrence, you're going to have to help me with her last name. Susan.
Oh, the doctor's granddaughter.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, well, my God. That's the same. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Yes.
The school, you have to understand, and I was going to ask Jim to confirm this, but the school that Clara taught at was the actual school that Susan, the granddaughter
of William Hartnell,
went to in the very first episode of Doctor Who, which was an unearthly child. We were first introduced to the school, and it pops up periodically because I think that there was a Dalek attack at one point under the tenant year.
Yes.
So we've come back to the school a lot. So that's the basic link to the Whoiverse.
Okay. So
that and the fact that the doctor sort of installed a few people here and left them there keeping an eye on things.
And there is a TARDIS ex machina kind of thing that happens in the first episode, which makes you think that the doctor and or a companion will be present throughout the series. And no, it's simply a gimmick in which to get people to watch the show and realize that there is Whovian DNA within it.
Though the doctor does make an appearance in the first
episode. Okay, spoiler. Yes.
Like he's not.
Okay,
like
that's why.
Sarah Jane.
Well, what it's TARDIS ex machina. In other words, there's a big mess, and all of a sudden, the TARDIS shows up, and actually, the doctor watches and advises to make everything work out, but he doesn't actually do it.
And this is the 13th doctor that we're talking about.
Peter Capaldi.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
And he never appears again for the entire series.
Right. Though the way they've set it up is the point is that he has them do it on their own because they have to learn and they must continue to do this good work long after he's gone back into his timey-wimey stuff.
The thing is that the series is very good. It too is one of those shows that has an auteur who did all of six episodes, I believe.
Someone getting dental work?
I mean, it sounds like that, doesn't it?
Sorry, good heavens.
In IMDb, I'll look it up. I seem to recall it was a total of six episodes, might be eight.
As we discussed earlier, it is not that odd these days for a series that has been canceled in one place to run somewhere else and then revive the series.
And that would be really lovely because in England, from what I have heard, the show has already been canceled for lack of good ratings. Not for lack of great, it got rave reviews. It is really, really good.
We're still talking about Class here, not Dungeon.
We're talking about Class, written by Patrick Ness, who wrote a novel a couple of years ago called A Monster Calls. Mm-hmm. And then wrote a movie called A Monster Calls, which came out last year, starring.
Okay, you still haven't watched because you and Barbara said to come over to watch it.
Yeah, which I've still yet to see, starring Felicity Jones and some other good people in it. And I'm really
so if you don't mind me asking, thematically.
Oh, it's eight episodes.
Thematically, with Class.
Class is eight.
I guess the question I have considering it is okay. So it seems to me as though the moral of any particular story involving a Whovian-level threat in teenagers is, oh my God, teenagers, walk away, leave this for the doctor. And yet it sounds like, nope.
There's a lot more to it than that.
That in this particular instance, the teenagers are the ones that we have no choice but to trust to ward off alien threats.
Okay, first of all, the most evil alien, arguably, that appears in the series is their lead teacher.
Okay.
So we're dealing with a lot of teenage angst to begin with. She's played by Catherine Kelly.
Oh, good. The teacher's the villain.
Who was,
is that
yes.
something that comes in after episode
that,
three?
That should, appeal to my guests here. That the teachers... What? Well, we've got teachers in the room. And the teacher's the villain. And Cam, you know, Cam really appreciates that, as no doubt Sam does. Catherine Kelly, who's wonderful in the series, best known apparently in England for Coronation Street, which is another one of those shows that are just totally beloved in England.
This is the angry blonde alien.
Yes.
Thinking of?
Yes,
she's not the villain. She's
she
forced
is
an, okay. She is a bad guy forced into being a good guy, which is one of the things I like about the
character.
You
haven't watched the whole series.
But I'm asked. I just asked you. So this happens after episode three. Okay. Whatever.
Episodes one and two.
I'm getting the sense that we the parameters for which we can discuss this are rather limited.
Yes,
so.
But let me say what I can say. Episodes one and two are Buffy-like monster of the week incidents.
Mm-hmm.
From episode three through eight. They are a continuing arc in which more about each character is revealed. At least one of the other characters we actually know from episode one mm-hmm. is not human.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is human and is, by episode two, radically changed forever. That also happens to another one of the characters. And by the end of episode eight, all bets are off. But episodes three through eight mm-hmm. are all one wonderful, brilliant arc. Telling a continuing story mm-hmm. and where you just can't wait. In fact, I might suggest
find out it's been canceled.
I might suggest
no more of it
watch episode one and then episode two as standalones and then wait a while, let them accumulate, and then watch the last six episodes on your own schedule because they are one story.
Now, I can tell you're a fan and that Terrence is too. I guess my question is, I mean, it seems as though when I first heard of the show, and let's be fair, there are other shows that you've brought up that would on their face have the same problem. You know, that in the case with Buffy, it's like, well, Buffy, stop going to high school. Stop hanging out with your friends. You're the Slayer. None of your social life matters anymore, nor should it be allowed to be. That it seems to be like so many shows have to walk this line. Now, and that would be fine. It's like, oh, but it's fun. It's like, yeah, it is, except this is a show that wants to be taken very seriously and go very dark. I'm talking about Buffy right now.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Buffy
yes.
right now.
Yes.
The stakes of the show are incongruous with the premise. Yeah, the stakes of the show are incongruous with the premise. And yet, I mean, I'm not saying this to diss Buffy. I'm just saying this to say that the central challenge of writing an episode of Buffy is to not let the kind of absurdity of its premise and its stakes, you know, just implode on each other.
Well, the original movie was insanely ridiculous. And the fact that he made a working TV series out of it was actually quite astonishing to me.
He had 4 years of apart.
Because it was very thin. Pee-wee was very funny.
But it's I loved him. I love Paul Rubens in that. The entire closing credits.
But to move to class, I guess. I mean, and I mean, I feel like to a certain extent, I mean, Torchwood was about adults with adult personalities and adult needs.
This is young adult,
right? But
it's not juvenile like Sarah Jane or Kate.
Adolescence, adolescent angst. Look, it's the same issues that. Mm-hmm. That the new Spider-Man is having because his friends are figuring out he's Spider-Man. The new Nova is having the same issues at school. His friends all figured out he's Nova. And actually the world mind said it's really okay to have friends so you can let them know you're Nova and maybe that takes some pressure off. So a lot of these things, the main thing with Buffy is like part of the funny thing about it is no one was paying her to be a Slayer.
Right.
It's like she had to go to school. She needed a backup plan. She's out there killing vampires, but no one's putting any checks in the bank for this. Which
someone's paying Giles a salary. I mean,
Every now and then you maybe kill the right vampire, you get a chest of gold out of it. But I mean, she really was like, they were on the edge of getting kicked out of that house at any given moment, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was, it's sort of a funny thing because it's like, yes, I'm the only one who can save the universe, but I have to get a good mark on my test next week or I don't get
scholarship because I can't afford college. None of that is relevant to class. None of that is relevant to class. It exists very much outside of the school structure, with the difference being that different creatures, people, aliens, characters come in, just as the doctor had gone to Cole Hall School pretending to be the janitor, for the custodian, actually, and that gets mentioned a great deal in episode one of class. Mm-hmm. That was this weird custodian, and he shows up as a custodian later.
But that is my fundamental question.
It stops being relevant to the school. The school is merely the setting.
The thing is, people at the school are being affected and disappearing in an episode.
In episode two.
And there is the same overlap. As I said earlier,
episodes one and two have nothing to do with the caricature of episodes 3 through 8.
Nonetheless, they exist, and it's how this series begins. That's what introduces you to it. What I'm saying is that, yes, they're on their own. They have to come up with the solutions. Partly that's programming, making kids be motivated to like think on their own, and there's lots of educational reasons this is put into TV shows. But also, the Sarah Jane adventures were the exact same thing. The only difference was, and it's not actually different, they had an adult supervisor. They had Sarah Jane and the three kids solved all, and the four of them solved all the problems. With this, there is actually a supervising adult, the evil teacher, who is an adult within the group, but evidently it stops being supportive.
Let's just say...
But the bottom line is, though, that they
don't,
do... Terrence, they are on their own, is what I'm saying.
Don't depend on that teacher being a supervisor for long, okay?
That's what I was just saying. That evidently she goes off from that point. But the bottom...
She evolves.
Stop spoiling.
She evolves.
But the bottom line is, the answer to Sam's question, there's no machina that comes back into play. They must deal with these things on their own. And they do rise to the occasion. They are a disparate group. There's the young black girl genius who's younger than anybody else and socially unacceptable. There's the young woman who's a little withdrawn and has now bonded with an alien. There's the alien who's now bonding with a Russian boy, you know, in a whole other way.
Doing bondage with the Russian boy.
Yes. So there's a nice little variation of characters from different groupings for different reasons. And essentially they're brought together by their common knowledge of the inciting incident and how horrific that is, but they're the only ones who understand that this stuff
that's
is
very
going
well
on
put. That's that's exactly right.
I mean, and that is what carries throughout the episodes that I've seen so far.
And it's interesting because, I mean, I for one did enjoy Torchwood, but I think that what made Torchwood interesting in its own way was the central challenge was that the Doctor is the latchkey to the universe, the Hooniverse, basically. That the Doctor is the mechanism by which you get to experience, you know, the entire universe that the show takes place in. A lot of people feel as though River Song should be more involved in the story. And I think River Song is a amazing character, but I think one of the reasons why the writers are very hesitant to bring her in, well, in this case, yeah, the head writer.
Who created her to begin with.
One, because he doesn't get women, but also because, if we're being fair, she can totally keep up with the Doctor's knowledge that she is his peer. She runs around the universe exactly as much as he has, perhaps for not as long as he has, and perhaps she doesn't know quite as much as he does. But
by the end.
Let
me tell you my
point is that the experience of Doctor Who hinges on a companion who will learn from the Doctor. You subtract that from the show.
Except that wasn't true in some of the original series. There was a scientist mm-hmm. who was smarter than John Pertwee. Mm-hmm. Of course,
there was another Gallifreyan Time Lord.
Yes.
He's had companions that were peers.
Yes.
He's had companions that were peers. They generally tend to avoid it for the same reason they don't bring in River Song too often. There's less conflict. The conflict
becomes I love Riverside. I had a great premise.
She's there, she just eats the show.
If only they had listened to me. I have the great premise for the season that is about to begin, which was, okay, I've got no problems that are hiring this woman as Bill, and she's a gay character and all that.
She's
goofy, she's black, and she's gay. I'm surprised they didn't put her in a wheelchair and give her one eye. I mean, they put a lot into that character.
Episode two, spoilers. But no, the thing that I wanted to see so much for this season, and I still think it would have been brilliant and a great writing challenge, especially for Moffat, is that the companion this year should have been, by all rights, River Song. They're married. It's about time that they had the adventures that have been promised to us and that we have been told that they have had. They should be together. She outwits him. He sasses her. She sasses him doubly. I cannot get enough of Alex Kingston in anything. Mm-hmm. By the way, everybody, watch the version of Moll Flanders that's available streaming.
Well,
if you're also Alex
Kingston. I'd love to see them do the
And Alex Kingston
with the
is Daniel Craig, by the way, in that. Mm-hmm. And so, husband and wife.
No, but they could do the Thin Man. I mean, it's that kind of a pairing.
Yes.
And that would be very funny.
Yes.
I mean, you know, that's the relationship is very much.
That's
Nick
exactly what I wanted.
Yeah. No, that would be a lovely thing, and I'm sure. Oh my God! There's no time to discuss this, and it's completely off topic. But I stumbled across something the other day that I just have to find out if other people know about. So I was sitting here. I don't know if it was Danielle or Esso. I think Danielle and Esso were here. We were looking for something, and we hit. And I can't remember the name of it. Someone out there is producing hour-long first-gen Star Trek episodes. They have the set, a set that looks just like it. They've got costumes. They've recast everybody playing the parts in much the same way the original actors did. And there are like 8 or 10 episodes of this. And they're an hour long each.
And it's over.
But what?
The lawyers got involved.
I'm looking and going, oh my God. Well, I've got to find them quick.
There was a settlement. On the one hand,
We'll let you keep playing what there is, but you can't make any more. Because that was my first question is like Paramount has to have signed off on this. There's like 10 episodes
of this.
They did
not.
There was litigation. How did this happen? Who funded this? This was like, there was money spent on this. The funniest thing was the opening tease of one had Scotty showing Kirk the first working model of the holodeck in a Western scenario, and then he turns it off. It seems interesting. I'm kind of working on it. We'll see where it goes. And I almost fell out of my chair.
There have been about 4 or 5 different iterations of Star Trek that have appeared nowhere but on YouTube.
But this was professional.
Yes, I know. Listen to me for a minute, please.
Star Wars, too.
Okay, not Star Wars. We're talking about $200,000 an episode. Nobody has ever done that with Star Wars.
Yeah,
we are
who's doing this?
I've had him on my show, for God's sake. Begins with a Z. His last name begins with a Z. And
not Zuckerberg, is it? He can pay that out of his petty cash.
Okay. If people don't want the answer, you don't want the answer. If you were to give me a minute, I would tell you. Zycroft, I think, is his name. M-A-R-C, let me look it up. He's very good. He's actually written a proper Star Trek. He is a very clever writer. He's very good. He's gotten backing from a lot of people, including, by the way, don't forget that wonderful little backer in Angel of TV Shows called Kickstarter and FundMe and all that. It's very easy if you get Mark Zicree, Z-I-C-R-E-E. There are terms under which you can go to Paramount and you can do certain things. But what you cannot do is use the troika of original characters. You cannot use Kirk, Spock, or McCoy
This was totally violating that.
You can use, for example, if you're careful, the number one that was played by Majel Barrett. You can use the Jeffrey Hunter character. You can go to alternate universes. There are things that Paramount will allow you to do if you ask real nice. If you use... and it probably didn't matter so much to them until J.J. Abrams came along and was successful in his reboot. And in his reboot, even though it's an alternate universe reboot, Paramount says, we're making money again, hands off. And sure. they were saying, but you didn't stop us before.
It's one of the reasons why, you know, it certainly looks like a good film, but I'm hoping that Spider-Man Homecoming doesn't quite break the bank at the box office in too big a way, because I think should that happen, that Sony will yank Spider-Man back away from Marvel.
The contracts are already done. Sony will be yanking it back. Homecoming is the only Disneyfied mm-hmm. Tom Holland Spider-Man film. But then Tom Holland goes back to Sony only production, where Sony has the rights to request certain cameos and stuff.
But if Homecoming does poorly enough, that will incentivize Sony to let Disney promote Spider-Man as a character.
Oh, they will promote him, and yeah. He may very well make a cameo in Infinity Wars.
Yeah.
But Sony is allowing this iteration of Spider-Man, which, as far as I can tell, even though I loved the satirical weird twist that Sam Raimi put on it in the first film, mm-hmm. this looks like, you know, judging from Captain America, the best Spider-Man yet. They just played him right. Oh, my God, he's a kid. Mm-hmm. Gee, who'd have thunk it? And
in the mid-90s, I was very attached to 25-year-old married Spider-Man who had a job.
But the problem with the trailer for Homecoming is that you almost see more Iron Man than you do Spider-Man.
Well, no one's gone wrong by betting on Robert Downey Jr. To carry a movie so far. So
Chaplin. But well, anyway.
In the Marvel Universe, I mean. But yeah.
He was actually
Tony Stark. Let me say.
Tony Stark.
Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark is essentially the protagonist of, I would argue, 8 Marvel films.
He is Ant-Man. He is Doctor Strange.
Is he an Ant-Man?
What I'm saying is the story that they take for Iron Man, the original Iron Man.
Get closer to your mic.
Yeah, the story arc they take for the original Iron Man is the same one they do for Ant-Man and for Doctor Strange.
Well,
that's what Dan Persons was saying in his
review.
You said that Iron Man took Ant-Man's plot. Not
yeah,
he
reversed that, yeah.
What Rob is saying is what Dan had said in his Doctor Strange review is that Marvel has successfully created a template that works very well for their intent. And all they have to do now is move some pieces around in each template. By the way, on the Ragnarok trailer, just one line and one line sells, at least the trailer, if not the movie from the...
Yes! It's my friend from work!
I know him from work! That's it.
What is this?
Thor Ragnarok. It's the third Thor film, which is... playing across a few different storylines, including Planet Hulk, and the big reveal is that Hulk shows up in exactly the Roman gladiator armor he wears in the comic for Planet Hulk.
And also,
couldn't be happier about it.
And there is a reference, if you watch Civil War carefully enough, they say, oh, I suppose that's why neither Bruce Banner or that Norse god are here. Well, this movie is concurrent to...
Because they're busy being in other movies. I want to see Thor Ragnarok and roll all night.
The trailer.
And party every day.
And party every day.
I'll tell you, I didn't particularly enjoy either one of the original Thor movies. That they were, the first one was okay. The second one was why did you make this movie?
Because you needed to really ruin Chris Eccleston's career.
even more so than it had been.
More than the G.I. Joe movies? I mean, my God.
Chris Eccleston was in those?
He was.
Oh, my God. Talk about a person who's made...
Yes.
But, you know, some people...
Fire his agent. That's all I can say.
Oh, remember him in 28 Days Later, though.
Yes.
I didn't watch any of those movies. I started watching 28 Days, and at the point they get to the house with the man and his daughter, it's like, they're all going to die. I just can't watch any more of this.
Oh, 28 Days Later.
It was like, I just stopped.
28 Days is about alcoholic recovery.
Well, what's the first one? 28 Days. What was the first play?
28 Days Later, and then they made a sequel 28 Weeks Later.
Right, 28 months later, 28 years later. I'm sure they could keep going. Mm-hmm.
Well,
but
the first
one
weeks later
I couldn't
has,
even get through. I can't deal with zombies anyway.
As the guy from the Full Monty, he's the main...
Two-minute warning, everybody.
Okay.
By the way. But the point is, just right now, there's a lot to talk about with the MCU, and we should get Dan involved in the next program where we discuss the MCU. And I really would like somebody of a different gender on this program to give a little diversity to this discussion. But right now we are at the cusp of the ending of one of the most remarkable television programs, period, not to mention one based on a comic. And that, again, listeners, is the series called Legion. It's really, I don't care if you like comic book shows or not, Legion is different.
If you like cinema and genre programs, then you must watch this.
Basically. Then there is also upcoming, if you liked Legion, if you like the work of Noah Hawley, he's got a new show for you. It's the third season of Fargo, seasons one and two of which were great. I don't believe you need to have seen seasons one or two. I think you can just dive into season three and you will be sated. And then number four, this coming Saturday, Fargo starts next Wednesday. In the same time slot Legion was in. What a coincidence. 2 weeks
I
can
watch until Legion comes back.
And then this Saturday evening at 9 p.m., the premiere of the final Capaldi / Moffat season. I am really sorry to see Capaldi go. And I want Moffat to continue writing the show but not running the show. Blink.
Haters.
Blink is good.
Yes, Blink. I will name a few episodes, and you'll realize those are all Moffat. I will name a few characters like River Song, like Captain Jack. This is all Moffat's contribution. The best things in Who Are Moffat as a writer, not as a showrunner or anything else, but as a writer, Moffat is par excellence as a showrunner. But Capaldi is classic Who come back personified. Mm-hmm. And after that, Class, taking the spin-offs to a level that if you liked Torchwood, you'll probably like Class.
It's Teen Torchwood.
Yes, it's Teen Torchwood. So we are about wrapping up here. Lister is in the room, of course. And in the background, very quietly, we will start. I said very quietly, 1 second. There. Very quietly. First, everybody state your name, your rank, and published fiction.
Terrence Taylor. My rank is,
and your
of course,
website.
Is Captain. TerrenceTaylor.com, 1 R, 3 E's, as I like to say, like Terrence Stamp or Terrence Trent D'Arby. No one remembers either of them anymore. I have published two novels, Bite Marks and Blood Pressure, working on the third, Past Life, even as we speak. I'm going back to that after I get off. And I have a new column coming up in Nightmare Quarterly in the spring issue of Nightmare Magazine. Read this, my recommendations of new horror.
And Cam, Rob, Cam.
My name is Rob Cameron. I'm an ensign, and my story Squeeze came out in Clockwork Phoenix 5, is still available.
And viewable online.
And viewable online. And also the audio is on Clydacast. And I am working on my first novel, so hopefully that'll be out before the end of the year. Well, we'll see.
Okay. But the Ensign's red shirts, are they the red shirts? Watch out.
I think those are the non-coms.
Yes. They never killed Walter
Kennedy. No officers.
okay. And
Sam?
Sam Schreiber.
They knocked him about, though.
Sam Schreiber.
Yeah, my name is Sam Schreiber, and I have a story coming out in about a week and a half in Analog Science Fiction and
Wow.
Fact.
Way called, cool.
Yeah. And following that, I've got a story coming out in High Concept Magazine. And following that, yes. In August, I've got a story coming out in Martian Migraine Press's anthology, A Breath from the Sky. It's a Lovecraft-themed anthology. And that same story should be coming out shortly thereafter in Tales to Terrify, which is part of the District of Wonders podcast.
Outstanding, Sam.
Okay, good stuff. All these people will be back more than once, and some of their friends. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. What I've got coming out is next week's program, starting at 1 a.m. Thursday morning, Wednesday night, depending on whether you're standing down or lying up. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper. Thank you, Terrence.
You're welcome.
And, I love that little Skype.
Bye-bye.
And goodbye from everybody, and good night to Cam, and good morning to Lister, who will be coming your way over these same airwaves just as soon as you can make it over here, Lister, because my theme music is about over, so stop getting naked! People can believe what I'm saying. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to bring the song back to the middle. Okay? There we go. So, I've made it longer. We've just dialed back the clock. And again, thank you all for listening. I am at ourwolf.com being redesigned. It's easier to find me on Facebook. There's an Hour of the Wolf group. There's a New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group. Where we have an event coming up May 2nd, May 31st, and June 6th. So be here. Have a good morning. Take care.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call it fist cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag, yeah. And burn.
99 Central, listen to live. WBAI. At exactly 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, thank you very much, Jim Frein. Great show. Back same place, same time, right here at 99.5 FM, WBAI. WBAI, 99.5 FM, New York. Yeah. WBAI.org. Jeffrey Chung producing Pablo Moses, Revolutionary Step. From the top, this tune we like to call Stepping with Baba Vake. Yeah. In these capitalist oppressive times. Hit it.
From reggae, I get to the red.